You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Nancy Princenthal. She's a critic and editor. She was formerly the senior editor at Art in America, a longtime contributor to that magazine. But her writing has also appeared in Art Forum, Art News, Parquet, and the New York Times, among other publications. She's also written a monograph on Hannah Wilke. And we're grateful you're with us today. Thanks, Nancy.
Thanks for having me.
So to begin with, I know you're working now on a book about Agnes Martin. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's coming along and what's happening with that book?
It's moving forward slowly. Like many projects that seem manageable when you embark on them, it turned out to be a more challenging undertaking than I imagined. She had a complicated and very private life. The interest in writing about her actually dates back to when I was an undergraduate. I wrote about her when I was in college. We exchanged a single set of letters. It kind of changed my life. Put it into a drawer until after I finished the Hannah Wilke book and was given an opportunity to follow up with a second book about an artist. And partly because Hannah Wilke's life and work are so closely intertwined, it seemed natural to pursue this Agnes Martin project as both a life and a monograph about her work.
Let's talk a little bit about those letters that you sent. That was at Hunter College, or where was that when you sent those letters?
I was at Penn, at the University of Pennsylvania, where, as it happens, Martin had a very important show just a few years before I got there. And I had seen her work and loved it. And it seemed challenging to me, the idea that abstraction that rigorous could also be that moving was something that really perplexed and interested me, and still does. Because I foolishly undertook to graduate without a major, I had to write a thesis defending that choice, and so I wrote an undergraduate thesis about Martin, and I was encouraged by somebody at the ICA on Penn campus, where this Martin survey had been, to send her a letter, ask her some questions that had been, perplexing me as I wrote my paper. And she wrote back in longhand, as was her style, and at length, and very generously, and essentially said, give up all this academic stuff, write from your heart. This is a story I used to tell a lot when I was teaching, and I thought, what good is this? Why can't she answer the particular questions? All the academic questions I felt I needed to address to get this paper. And her letter has stayed with me over the years, and I've thought long and hard about the direction she was trying to push me in. Essentially, what she said was, follow your heart. So that's something I've tried to convey.
Which is right, like Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss, but it seems almost an impossible task in its practicality. And here you are at college. I mean, that's a very interesting position. You're essentially defending in a thesis why you're not declaring a major, mm-hmm. but deserve to graduate.
Yes.
Right.
True.
So that's very interesting. Now, you said four letters. I mean, there was a few letters.
No, just a single
single letter.
There and back. And what I didn't realize at the time, but now know, is that she was writing from a place of rather extreme isolation. She was living at the time in a place called Cuba, New Mexico, altogether on her own, without electricity, without any of the amenities. And living a kind of desperate life at that time. So it was really an act of some generosity for her to respond at all.
And how did that change the writing of your thesis? How did that figure into your thinking?
It was more a kind of provocation. I don't think I responded to it adequately then, so I'm trying to make up for it now.
But your thesis obviously succeeded. I mean, to me, that's also a wonderful story to you know, I think in a way it's important now to be able to not declare a major impossible. it took me a few years in college before I realized I could. I went to SUNY Purchase before I realized I could kind of make up my own major, but mm-hmm. it's not the kind of thing they tell you when you come in there. You know?
No, they don't. Not in a good liberal arts school like that.
Right, and it's not encouraged, really, it seems. So that's interesting. So that started out your journey, you know, in a way as a writer, I would imagine. What happened after that? So you graduated from Penn, and then what happened?
And then I went straight into the Whitney Independent Study Program, which was an incredibly lucky stroke. It was the only thing I had, you know, in mind to do. I thought either I would stay in Philadelphia and, you know, get some kind of job there. I had actually met Richard Flood, who was publishing a little staple-bound black and white magazine called the Philadelphia Arts Exchange. That was my maiden voyage as a critic, writing about shows in Philadelphia and suburban Philadelphia galleries for the Philadelphia Arts Exchange, and I don't know, maybe earning $5 a review or something. I don't remember actually whether I was compensated at all, but I thought, okay, I'll stay here, or I'll, you know, if I get into the ISP, I'll do that. And I got in. And that was also a game changer. It was a very different program then than it is now. It was just one semester long, and we all were required to, those of us who were in the curatorial art history side of it, there were then two sides, that one and the studio, and it's a little different now. And we had to produce shows, all of us, within that 6 months, or it was less than 6 months, probably a 5 month period. So we really had to hit the ground running. And there were visiting guests every week, of, you know, sort of unforgettable people, from Susan Sontag to Yvonne Rainer.
Wow.
And we learned a lot.
And so you said you had to hit the ground running. You had to curate a show. What did you have to do?
Yeah. I believe I participated in two shows, although I think officially I was only involved with one. And oddly enough, one of them was called Out of the House, and it was a show, this was 1977, it was a show about women artists who were involved with domestic issues and imagery in their work. And in 1977, we ran up against a fair amount of pushback from the artists we approach, many of whom, although they described themselves as feminists, felt that it was... that battle had been fought and not won, but advanced enough that they were tired of being shown in exhibitions that were only of women. So it's funny to find myself so many years later still involved with women artists. I'm also the co-author of two books that have come out in the past 3 or 4 years about women artists and their place in the contemporary art world. And I think now women are actually more willing to say, yeah, you know, it's been a long fight and it's not over. So
right.
That's changed.
Well, we know so many things like that in terms of even, you know, reproductive rights. You know, it seems like
mm-hmm.
the clock is turning back in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It seems extraordinary that battles that were seem to be fought and won have to be fought again on the same
Absolutely.
Level almost.
Absolutely.
And do you think that's happening in the art world as well? That's an art world issue as well, the role of women. I mean, certainly the Guerrilla Girls were, you know, kind of one of the latest iterations of that, but that's actually, I guess, about 20 years old now.
Yeah. You know, one of the authors of these two books, one of the books is called After the Revolution, and the second about younger artists is called The Reckoning. One of the authors, Sue Scott, has coordinated the assembly of a new set of statistics showing how far women have come in the art world. And there was a great deal of improvement that plateaued in roughly in the 90s in the nonprofit world, the museum, biennial, that circuit world, there is rough parity. It fluctuates, but in the gallery world, for women to have solo shows is still not anywhere near as likely as men. The numbers are really quite disappointing. And the same is true for women's work in the marketplace. So not that those are the only standards, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
And that's very interesting because I interviewed Marilyn Mittner and Mary Heilman, and I remember Marilyn Mittner said, she said, today there's no way, you know, a woman can be like Damien Hirst. They can't be quite as white hot as he is. And Mary Heilman said, I asked her about that and mentioned Marilyn's comment, and she said, that's absolutely not true. I am as hot as Damien Hirst. When I walk into a room, everybody knows who I am.
Well, you know. I really, really applaud her spirit. And I, you know, I love both of them and their work, and I really wish it were true. I can't altogether say that it is.
Right. I mean,
not that being Damien Hirst is everyone's dream of being an artist, but he commands a different kind of attention.
Right. So then, after the Whitney Independent Study Program, it was curatorial projects that you got involved in, or what happened next? So you're in New York City and you're starting your career. Was it with writing, or how did that grow?
It was a lot of things mixed up together. So after I left the Whitney, I went to I started working at Printed Matter fairly quickly. I think by the spring of 78, I was assistant manager at Printed Matter, which was then a tiny little storefront on Lisbonard Street in Tribeca. It was about 6 months or a year old at that point. The nominal director was Ingrid Sishi, who went on to become a writer and editor and just an enormous education for me. I was completely unfamiliar until I arrived there with the whole project of artist books. I barely knew what an artist book was. So the idea that there were so many people involved with the idea of making inexpensive offset, Xeroxed, you name it, artist publications that constituted a form of original artwork in book form was in a way of circumventing the gallery system that was the idealism behind it was really exciting and very immediate, very hands-on. And then soon after that, I started working for Creative Time, which was then programming a series of summer exhibitions and performances at what we called The Beach. This program was called Art on the Beach. It was the landfill that later became Battery Park City, 10 acres of that landfill. It's a terrific program, and I think a lot of artists involved with that look back on it as kind of this very kind of innocent time in the New York City art world. And
yeah, I remember some images from that. I can't think of who it was. It's slipping my mind, but an image of kind of a woman in a field at Battery Park. What was it?
Well, you know, Agnes Dennis did what she called the wheat field at the landfill. There were some rogue projects that went on there before Creative Time got permission to program these 10 acres on an ongoing basis. Mary Miss also did a really interesting project out there without the support of Creative Time. I forget who funded that. But the Creative Time program brought about a dozen artists out there. For about 8 years, I forget exactly how long the program continued. So we did that, and we also started programming installations and performances at the Anchorage on the Brooklyn side of the Brooklyn Bridge. That was called Art in the Anchorage. It was just a very exciting period in the nonprofit world that benefited from real estate in New York basically being in the toilet. So there were all these spectacular spaces that were available, and municipal authorities looking for artists to make them seem attractive. So it was
right. Well, and the Anchorage was extraordinary, and that went on for quite a long time. That
it
was
did.
Well into the 90s, or yeah. I think up to 9/11. I think that was running.
I think it stopped and started a few times. And there were some lean years for Creative Time after I left, when the budget of the National Endowment for the Arts stalled during the Reagan years. But of course, now Creative Time has had this amazing reemergence. So,
right, they're kind of super funded, it seems. You know, they seem one of those organizations that are, because I actually helped years ago with some of the installations, you know, helping them put some of the installations, and the funding that Ann Pasternak has put together is, you know, is quite extraordinary. Although it, you know, it tends to fund, you know, artists that are very well known is what I hear younger artists talking about, and I've noticed myself, because as a and perhaps this is true or not, but as a result of getting funding, having big names helps, and it's harder to get funding for younger artists. Do you think that's part of what's happening there, or no?
You know, I think they're aiming and mostly succeeding at a pretty good mix of artists who are well known and artists who are less known. Of course, everyone's definition of what those two categories are is a little different. I think that was always the case. And I think they've been doing some great stuff. I know they've really moved out into the world. It's not any longer a local organization or even just a regional one, and I think that's all good. I think the effort to work in the community is still the thing that motivates them, and that's what Creative Time was up to from the start.
Right. Yeah, I think they've just done some wonderful things. The Anchorage was always one of my favorite spaces because it was just such an almost impossible in space to install anything in. The scale of it is like working in a cathedral. You know, what isn't dwarfed by that? You know?
The scale, the history, the, you know, the romance of it. And the first time we walked in there, I thought, oh my God. I mean, you know, it felt like walking into a space that no one had seen in 100 years. It had been used for storage for a long time. So it was kind of exciting time.
Yeah, to me it felt like something from a science fiction movie. Like you come into this lost tomb and suddenly a cathedral-sized space that's empty. hard to believe it exists. So at that time you were curating, and that doesn't sound like a living then, but did that lead into writing or a career in writing?
Let's see. When I started working at Creative Time, it was a three-person staff, and it pretty much remained that way for the 4 or 5 years that I was there. And while I was there, I went back to school. I went to graduate school at Hunter and was also beginning to write. I look back, and I'm not sure how all these pieces quite fit together, but I did finally complete a master's degree in art history at Hunter. Having bagged the idea of going for a doctorate, I just didn't feel that academia had as much to offer as, you know, just being in the world. And I think that was a good decision. Sometimes I think it might have been nice to finish that academic path, but I was having a lot of fun, and the writing was something that happened in after hours for a long time. I started writing for Art News at that time, and then by the early mid 1980s, I was also writing pretty regularly for Art in America. So I've been associated with Art in America for a long time.
Well, and I think Agnes Martin would have applauded the lack of pursuing academia and maybe figured in slightly to that you were doing what you loved as opposed to what would be a traditional academic path that would have helped maybe in other ways, but it sounds like you were doing something that was more from the heart.
I enjoyed what I was doing, yeah. Yeah, I liked, you know, the thing about what a doctorate seemed to offer at that point was that it seemed not to to be a place where you could have the same kind of engagement with artists that everything else I was doing offered, including especially writing. That was what I enjoyed about writing from the beginning, was being part of a conversation that was happening in real time.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, Agnes Martin and maybe Hannah Wilkie too, because I know of your monograph, and Hannah Wilkie, I have to say, was the first artist that impressed me enormously. I was at SUNY Purchase. I heard a lecture of hers, and this was before she had cancer. It was, I guess, early 80s, and she was talking about beauty, and I remember her showing, you know, I get kind of chills thinking about it, but I remember her showing an image I think it was a skinned cow head, an image of her mother with mastectomy, and you know, was saying, what is beauty? You know, it's you know, what makes something beautiful or not beautiful? And, you know, I was overwhelmed by that. I thought it was, you know, it's just one of those things that completely marked me. And I didn't write letters to her. I wish I had, but I remember seeing her in a Soho cafe not long after that, and I had to just say to her, that was, you know, an incredible talk. I was, you know, enormously moved. Do you think that your interest in her has a tie in to Agnes Martin, or is there a relationship there?
That's so interesting. You know, I have thought of them as about as far apart from each other as two artists can be in personality, in the mediums they chose to work in the way,
the way they work, everything, yeah.
Yeah, the way they conducted their lives. As I said before, Hannah's life and her work were so thoroughly intertwined, and what she was most committed to was honesty, was, you know, candor about being a woman, candor about being beautiful when she was, and about being ravaged by illness when she was. I think for a lot of people that final work that she did when she was so sick helped them to see in a way that is tragic, but has, you know, there's a kind of poetic justice to it. Helped them to see what she had been doing from the outset. She occupied a very contested place in the world of women's work when she was doing the performance-based work earlier, and all of that, you know, just having the courage to, you know, stride naked into the, you know, art world of the 70s and 80s was, I think, her strongest achievement. Just to be that affirmative about the desire to express a joy in living, express a desire for beauty, and everything about Agnes Martin is about the experience of a kind of disembodied joy, a disembodied emotional response, and it depends on a language of abstraction. It depends on being able to respond to something that has no correspondence in the, you know, in the visible world. She always denied associations to even things as general as the landscape, as light, as weather. I mean, things that people can't help seeing in her work. So I'm thinking about the relationship between them, and I think you're right. There is something about beauty.
Well, it's interesting that Agnes talks about, you know, writing from the heart, you know, and perhaps, you know, it just seems unlikely given, you know, the kind of formalist strategy she's employing as opposed to, you know, Hannah Wilke, you could see saying, you know, paint from the heart, perform from the heart, do what you love or feel. But it's hard to imagine Agnes Martin saying those same things. I mean, what comes to mind, and I don't know if this is a bridge at all between the two, but is Ellen Gallagher. Do you know her work at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some of Ellen Gallagher's early work looked a lot like Agnes Martin.
Oh, yeah.
Those blind canvases.
Yeah, I think that reference is absolutely deliberate. And I think, it's part of the power of Gallagher's work is that she takes that language and undermines it and, you know, insists on the fact that there is gender, there is a racial politics and a gender politics and a cultural politics to everything. Which is something that Agnes would have contested. She would have said, absolutely not. In fact, she did say, absolutely not. By the end, she was quite firm about that. I'm not a feminist. I don't believe in feminism. I don't believe that art has a gender. Art is a universal language. It's a tough thing to argue.
And how do you reconcile that? I mean, that seems hard for me to understand now and believe, but how do you reconcile what one way seems like such a tender letter that she wrote you and so heartfelt with this sense? Because didn't Roy Lichtenstein talk a little bit that way? This has nothing to do with my feelings. This has nothing to do with anything almost, you know? And it seems that, you know, so many people have been moved by his work or Agnes Martin's work in so many ways.
She wanted people to be moved. That, you know, that is central to her work. But she wanted it to be an emotion that was in some way universal and abstract. And as an aspirational belief, absolutely. Universal is a tricky word to use and gets us into deep water very fast. It's impossible to say that her work would speak in the way she intended to everyone, everywhere, eternally. But I, for my experience, for our time, I think it does speak. And I think it speaks quite powerfully and to a whole lot of people.
Yeah, Agnes Martin is a fascinating figure on many levels. I think the year she was in was Cuba, New Mexico, correct? That she was also not painting for a while then. Wasn't that the case?
Yeah, that's right. You know a lot about her. She spent 10 years in New York. She was born in Canada and went from Canada to the Northwest and from there to Teachers College of Columbia University in New York and from there to New Mexico. So she had been in New Mexico and was back and forth between New Mexico and New York for several years before she came to New York in 1957 and stayed for a decade. Mm-hmm. And it was she was born in 1912. By the time she got to New York, she was in her mid-40s. And settled on Coenties Slip, which is an incredibly interesting community of artists down at the seaport in Lower Manhattan. And by age is associated with the abstract expressionists and actually also by inclination. She always identified herself with that generation, with the generation of Pollock, not so much de Kooning, who she didn't identify with, but with that generation. Ed Reinhardt was a close friend. Ellsworth Kelly, and she stayed in New York until 1967, at which point she left rather abruptly. The reasons for her leaving are not entirely clear. And there was a period of travel. There was a period of excursion and some trouble, and she resumed painting. This is something that has been a little bit murky. She resumed painting within 4 or 5 years, but she never came back to New York to live. So the departure, at just the point where she had begun to achieve really considerable success, has become sort of the stuff of, you know, a certain amount of legend. It became part of the persona that was identified with Agnes Martin, the kind of saint of the desert, somebody who threw off the, you know, the social life and the opportunities and the market success that had been offered in New York and went to live this much more ascetic life. And there's some truth to it.
I mean, but also she did continue to sell work. And even during that time, as when you were in school, she was having exhibits. I mean, is that correct? She was.
Yeah, it is. By 1974, she had made a connection with Arne Glimcher at Pace Gallery, which has represented her ever since. Pace still represents the estate. And she always wanted to be successful. She overcame considerable odds and real personal difficulty to make that happen. So, you know, there was this absolute determination to have the work be seen, not just to make it, which was a very powerful personal drive, but she really couldn't have endured without making the work that she did, but it was not enough to make it. It had to have an audience, and the audience response in her mind, not hers alone, is what completes the work.
So, and with Ed Reinhardt, I'm sorry, go on. So right, so it was being exhibited and the importance of it being out there, not just made.
Yeah, and she knew she wanted a gallery that could really make that happen, and she achieved that. Her first gallery in New York was Betty Parsons, who was also a personal friend and ran this, you know, you probably know the Betty Parsons story,
sure.
Ran a history-making gallery that failed to make any of the artists associated with it financially stable, so they all...
Ed Reinhardt was part of that crowd, was
he? Yes, he was.
And that was also, I mean, from what I know, Ed Reinhardt was a friend of hers at some point. I suppose he is an abstract expressionist, but I don't think of him that way. Is he an abstract expressionist?
Not really. You know, he's of but. That generation, and Ellsworth Kelly is also... of that generation that can be called New York School painters, but it would be a mistake to call their work expressionist. They are abstractionists, and they were all quite close. Martin was close with Ellsworth Kelly. He also lived down at Coenties Slip, and she was quite good friends with Reinhardt, who died in 1967. Some people have associated his death with her departure, although that doesn't seem to have been exactly the precipitating factor. But they had a great deal in common in terms of their interests. They were both really interested in Eastern spiritual systems, in kind of reductive painting, in painting at the threshold of visibility. That was something they came to together, at serial painting, at, you know, fixed formats and work that's created within very strict parameters. That was also something they sort of arrived at roughly the same time. But it was it was an interesting and deep friendship.
And yeah, I mean, it's hard to guess what happened at the end there, but Ed Reinhardt committed suicide, didn't he, or no?
No.
No, he didn't.
He died young. He died unexpectedly young, but no, he didn't commit suicide. You know, that generation is, the men have had a very poor track record of making it into old age. De Kooning was one of the very few who did.
That's true. From I mean, like Pollock and Rothko, all
Rothko committed suicide, yeah.
right. Interesting. So that's a fast. That sounds like a fascinating book. I'm looking forward to reading it. And
Thank you.
it sounds to me. I mean, it's interesting talking about her. I didn't expect to talk so much about Agnes Martin, but now I think her work does seem to relate more to Ad Reinhardt and that school of what I think of as color field painters. But I understand that maybe just the New York school is a better way to think of it, of that generation. But I would never think of her as an abstract expressionist either. I mean, certainly it's
Yeah.
abstract, but
Although that's what she
yeah.
called herself. And, you know, of course, by the time she left New York, she was being shown alongside younger artists who were identified with minimalism, which is a term she rejected. But, you know, there she was being shown with, you know, Sollowit and Donald Judd and Carl Andre. And so her career and her work and her life straddled a number of very different worlds.
It's very interesting. It's been wonderful to talk to you, Nancy. I want to discuss a little bit in closing, just about, I guess, the role of the critic and writer today. You know, there's artists are, you know, there's questions about the role of the critic, I think, from a number of artists, certainly figures like Jerry Saltz, who seem to be, you know, very popular on Facebook and in other places, to talk about the role of the critic as being much less important than artists give them credit for. I mean, you know, he has this line where he says, you know, the artists he's championed the most sometimes go nowhere, and artists that he intensely dislikes seem to go everywhere. Well, what is the role of the critic in terms of an artist's studio production or work, you know, or you know, that could be through the eyes of someone like Agnes Martin, how she would see it, or but I'm of course asking for artists today and what the role of the critic is. Is it value judgments? Is it feedback? Is it, what is it exactly?
Such a good question. Let's see. You know, I teach in the art criticism and writing program at SVA. It's an MFA program in art criticism. So I have to think about this part because I'm operating under the assumption that art criticism is a living discipline and that people are going to continue to go out there and do it. It has changed so much. And of course, the biggest agent in that change is the digital world, everything that happens on the internet, starting with blogs and moving into social media, and the decline of print media, which is, you know, where I have lived a lot of my life as a writer, writing for magazines as well as catalogs and books. So there's no question that power is shifting within the art world. I think there is a tendency for critics to look back and say there used to be a great deal more power vested in critics. And the person they always have in mind is Clement Greenberg. There was this moment when, you know, a critic could call the shots, could tell artists what to do, could tell collectors what to buy, could tell museum curators what to show, and that moment can't be recaptured. And it probably shouldn't be. You know, we're never going to go back to a time where anyone calls the shots like that and shouldn't. But I think it's a really, really interesting time to be a writer. I think everyone is in the conversation now. I think writers have much, sorry, artists have much more control over what's said about their work than they used to, and that's a good thing. You know, we hear artists' voices a lot more than we used to, all over the place, in magazines, on the internet, in blogs. There's a lot more known about people in all cultural production fields. We live in a much more personality-based time, So that's come into writing much more than it used to. I think the disciplines that come to bear on art criticism have really been moving around lately in a good way. It's not just, say, literary theory or psychoanalytic theory, or it's all sorts of stuff, ranging from, you know, neuroscience to poetry to, you know, whole new disciplines coming into the discussion. You know, I think Jerry Saltz is a pretty powerful guy. I think his wife is a pretty powerful writer, but power is part of it. Being part of the conversation, as I said at the beginning, is also a huge part of it, just feeling that it's helpful to, you know, for artists to have other people to bounce their ideas off of, for artists to get organized kinds of responses, thoughtful kinds of responses to what they do. And that's the, you know, that's the payoff, I think, for us critics.
Right. I mean, for critics to, it's, so, I mean, in that sense, it's feedback for artists getting thoughtful responses to work that they have made and exhibited or posted on a Facebook page that Jerry mm-hmm. Saltz or somebody is responding to get a thoughtful response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Jerry himself is, you know, at his best, a great critic, you know, who can make some pretty thoughtful responses himself. So, you know, criticism comes in lots and lots of different flavors, and it's better that it should. And I think that also, you know, characterizes our moment. We're not living in a world where, you know, one or two magazines control the vocabulary, set the tone.
And in conclusion, I really enjoyed talking with you. In conclusion, artists are listening to this that aren't just young, they're mid-career, they're mature artists. Is there, and they're thinking, of course, you know, I'd like my work to be written about more or be part of the conversation is something I hear a lot. Is there anything you want to leave with them about what it means to be part of the conversation and how to insert yourself into that conversation?
How to insert yourself into that conversation? You know, I think there are an awful lot of opportunities now. And I think very often artists underestimate, you know, who's seeing their work, who's talking about their work. It's impossible to really know everyone who's made a response. You know, I think there have never been more opportunities to show work. I do hear quite a bit that in the art world, as everywhere else, there's an increasing polarization between the very few at the top and the vast majority operating on a shoestring. You know, I think that's the case. And there are certainly, you know, completely unjustified absences of people we should be seeing more and hearing more from. I guess, honestly, I'd have to say that in terms of finding gallery representation, that's never been something that, you know, we on the critic end have been very good at offering advice on. It's sort of like getting published. I don't, you just
right,
have to,
right.
You know, introduce yourself to as many people as you can.
And in the conversation, though, I mean, it isn't so much about being in galleries, although right, it's introducing yourself to a lot of people, but is social media, do you think, and blogs and JPEGs a way of artists reaching out? Is that a valid form? I mean, now artists are creating pages on Facebook and websites mm-hmm. and blogs and all of this. Is that also a way of entering the conversation? I mean, relevancy is what artists talk about too, and I've even heard about this with major artists. And I don't want to mention names, but major artists running big art departments at important schools say things like, you know, I'm doing well, but my art isn't talked about. And maybe, you know, you're right. He or she may not realize how much their art is being talked about, but it's this sense of I'm not part of a conversation. People aren't talking about me like they are Marilyn Mintner or somebody like that.
Yeah, you know, there are a very small number of people who really do suck up a lot of airtime. But then there's everyone else, and among the everyone else, which is, of course, where most of our interest lies, you know, there is a limit to how much we want to hear about, you know, Damien Hirst or whoever, you know, the equivalents are. But it's the everyone else that is, you know, that is really where the heart of the matter is. And whether or not there's going to be a spotlight on you that, you know, lands you at the top of, you know, the auction news or, you know, in Zwerner and Gagosian is, I think, the wrong question. You know, the right question is, are the people I care about talking about my work? You know, just like it's not about how many people a museum can get through its doors. It's about the quality of the response. So, you know, I think turning away from numbers as a way to, you know, gauge whether the work is meaningful is probably the most important decision to make.
Thank you. I think that's a very important point. And thank you so much for talking with us today, Nancy. I really appreciate your time and this interview.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Nice getting to know you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.